All right, we're going to go ahead and start our class. Stephen and Victoria and our teens are down in Augusta this morning. They went to the SOAR Youth Rally this weekend, and they're worshiping down there this morning. So I'm going to be doing class and also our sermon. One of the things that I wanted to do here, and you know, this is just a little one-time class, but Stephen has been leading us in a study of the Bible in chronological terms. And we were looking at, you know, the 40 years they were in the desert, and didn't take us very long to get through, because he looked, you know, he said, okay, this month they went to here and this month they went to there, and we kind of talked over that. It took us like 2 weeks. But there's so much in there. You know, it's interesting to learn the Bible in chronological order, and we've learned a lot from that. But sometimes you run across these things, you just go, ooh, can we just stay there? Can we just stay there and get into it? There's so much good stuff in there. And so I thought I'd do one little one. The thing that got me was when we were talking about the children of Israel are at the Jordan River. Okay, they've been wandering the desert for 40 years. Joshua is telling them, God tells Joshua, okay, tomorrow, you know, you're going to cross the river. And it says, when they cross the river, the manna stopped. And most of the times you just read right over the top of that, right? Because you really, you know, what's going to, they're going to knock down the walls of Jericho here. Everybody's getting excited. And they're going to walk through the water on dry land and all this kind of stuff. But it says, the manna stopped. And I got to thinking, I said, so what was life like for 40 years? Those 40 years. Now, what do we know? Why was that 40 years there? Why were they wandering in the desert for 40 years? Anybody remember?
Blessed generation of sins.
Yeah. The older generation was being punished. And why were they being punished?
Disobedient.
They were disobedient because God said, you're going to go take this land. They sent in the spies, and what happened? They didn't believe. The 12 spies went in. Joshua, Caleb, and 10 others, whose names have gone down in infamy. No one even remembers them unless you look them up. But everybody remembers Joshua and Caleb. They went into the land, and what did they find?
Giants.
They found giants, yes. And what else did they find?
Good stuff.
A land flowing with milk and honey. Even the guys who said they couldn't take it and there were too many giants says, it is indeed a land flowing with milk and honey. But they said, man, we were like grasshoppers walking around there. Now, some of y'all understand that standing around me. But, you know, Goliath was probably 9 feet tall. Okay? I'm only six and a half, 6'8". So, you know, there were some big dudes there, and they were some strong armies. And yeah, so they came back and they said, we can't do it. And God said, and all the people picked it up too, didn't they? It wasn't just those 10 guys. If those 10 guys had come back and everybody said, nah, we're not going to listen to you, we're going to listen to Joshua and Caleb, they would have gone and taken the land. But they didn't. What did they do? They got discouraged and they cried out to the Lord, oh God, why did you bring us out here? You know, Moses, what? All our children are going to fall, they're going to die, and we're all going to be killed. And God said, okay, since you aren't going to believe me, you're going to wander in the desert until everybody 20 years old and older has died off. 40 years it took. Now, we do have in the Bible some accounts of some of the things that happened in those 40 years. Do you remember some of them? What happened during the 40 years they were wandering in the desert? They had a couple wars, right? Amalek came and attacked them once. That's why God really got angry and upset at Amalek. Amalek came and attacked them. They ran out of water a bunch of times. The people complained, and Moses had to strike a rock or, you know, whatever to bring water to them. We're going to talk about that today. They were hungry. Yeah?
His horses talked to the rock, not hit it. That's the reason why he didn't go to the
That's right.
Promised land.
So there was a time when God told him to strike the rock. There was another time when God told him to speak to the rock. And Moses was so angry that he said, must we bring water from this rock? And he struck the rock. Now water came out of the rock, but there were two sins there. God said what? Speak to the rock, don't strike it. And what did he say? Must we bring you water from this rock? Right? And for that reason, Moses didn't get to enter the promised land. Now, so lots of stuff going on. How much do you know about the Sinai Peninsula, which is mostly where they were wandering? It's dry as a bone. You know, the modern population of the entire Sinai Peninsula is a little over 500,000 people. The modern, with irrigation, with trucking in food supplies, and modern cities, and everything else, the entire population, modern population of the Sinai Peninsula is 500,000 people. How many people were wandering around the Sinai Peninsula for 40 years? Somewhere between 2 to 3 million or more. Right? And we know that because there's a place in the Bible we just covered that said there were they took a census and there were roughly 600,000 warriors, 550 or something like that. And there were 600,000 warriors between the ages of 20 and probably 60, which is the age that men were allowed to go to war. So if there were 600,000 men that age, how many of them do you think had wives? Probably most of them. How many think of those had kids? If they were 50 to 60, how many had grandkids? There were a lot of people, right? So somewhere between 2 to 3 million people, it doesn't really matter precisely. We're never told precisely, but it's a bunch of folks. And where had they just come from?
Egypt.
Did they go out of Egypt with nothing but the shirt on their back? No. What did they take with them?
Everything
they owned and just about everything the Egyptians owned. Because you remember what happened. God sent the plagues, right? Pharaoh hardened his heart, wouldn't let him go. And God kept sending plague after plague after plague after plague. And then finally, he sends the plague, the plague of the firstborn. And he finally says, leave. Take whatever you want. take anything. And it said that God made the Egyptians disposed to give valuable things to the Hebrews. So there's 2 to 3 million people. By the way, there's besides the Hebrews, there's something on the order. There were several thousand who were not Hebrews, who were Egyptians and other folks who were kind of hanging on with them, who decided to go with them. And they ended up causing problems later. But they came out with all the wealth of Egypt, including, what were they doing in Egypt? What job did they have in Egypt when they first got there? What were they?
Shepherds.
They were shepherds. And the reason they were shepherds was the Egyptians hated taking care. It was detestable to them. Remember when Joseph and his brothers, and he was going to introduce his brothers to Pharaoh, and he said, guys, tell him you're shepherds, because that means they're going to let you have the good place for the cattle. And they hate shepherds. They think shepherds stink. They're detestable. And so they were shepherds. Well, what also did they do when they were in Egypt? Made a lot of bricks, right? Built a lot of stuff, made a lot of bricks. But they did have a lot of livestock, which would have been cattle, sheep, and goats. Okay, probably some mules and horses and stuff as well too, but cattle, sheep, and goats. So how many cattle, sheep, and goats do you think left Egypt? We don't know. But I did a rough estimate and figured probably about 1 million animals. You know, if it was like all the flocks and herds of Egypt, or at least the ones that survived. Remember, all the hail and everything else had killed all the Egyptians' critters. So the only critters that were left, basically, in the country were the ones belonging to the Hebrews. And I figured it's probably, this is all just guessing on my part, about 250,000 of the cattle. But for every cow, you probably had three or four sheep or goats. So, you know, you had kind of this many folks. They wandered around the desert for 40 years. What does the Bible say about that time period? When they were wandering around the desert, what was it characterized by? There were good and bad. One thing God said, remember when they were at the Jordan River and they were hollering because, you know, the spies went in, they came out and they said, oh my, you know, let us go back to Egypt, you know, all this kind of stuff. God said, your carcasses will fall in the desert. Those are the words he used. He doesn't say you will die, you will go sleep with your fathers. There's a lot of polite ways that God talks about dying in the Bible. Your carcass falling in the desert is not one of those kind ways. Okay? So, and he says in the desert, this is a deserted place. Now, it's not all sand and cactus, but it's pretty deserted. If you go look there, it's a lot of dry ground and a lot of rock. And there's some oases. There's a couple places where there's some water and a few things, but mostly it's desolate. Now, so they're all out there. And so how in the world are they going to survive for 40 years? Let's just say 2 million people for a second. Let's go on the low end here. 2 million people, 1 million animals. How are they going to survive in the desert?
was God's help.
Exactly. And in fact, that was part of the reason. Part of the reason was to punish the older generation for lack of faith. Part of the reason was they trained up a whole generation. 40 years, people were having babies. Right? By the time they got back to the Jordan River, you know how many warriors they had? About 600,000. It was only a few thousand less than the number that they originally had when they came out of Egypt. Which means that a whole generation grew up during that time. And that whole generation knew nothing except life in the desert. You think they were fairly tough characters? They didn't lay around all day, did they? And so you wonder, how in the world did all this go? So I started doing some math, I started doing some research, and I came up with a few things, and I've got some visual aids here to help us. So first of all, water. If you don't have water in the desert, this first thing everybody thinks of, you're in the desert, if you don't have water, you're going to die. How much water do you have to have in the desert to survive every day? Now I put 1 liter up here. That is kind of a bare minimum. The U.S. Army expect soldiers in desert, like in Desert Storm or something like that, to have on the order of a gallon or two a day, and that depends on how hard they're working. And a big chunk of military success is getting food and water to the troops, right? That's a huge part of the reason you win or lose a war. And if your daddy was here, he could tell us all about it, because he was a cook. That was his job in the military, was he ran the kitchens. And he could tell them. But I did some studying. I looked at it. There's actually people who today will go out and walk across the Sahara just pulling a cart by hand. And they say they can survive on between 1 and 2 liters of water a day. You know, so you know it's possible. So I just said, okay, let's just say minimum, make the math easy, about a liter of water a day. And then as food goes, of course, they end up eating manna, which we're going to talk about. But as food goes, it takes about 2 loaves of bread to keep someone alive. That's all they're eating is bread, and have any kind of health at all, not just be starving. It takes about 2 loaves of bread. We studied that. Remember when we studied in John, we talked about the loaves and the fishes. We studied about how much bread it took and all that kind of stuff. Well, that's about 2 liters of flour. Now, I rounded some of these numbers off, you know, just to make the math easy. So you had to have, for every one of those 2 million people, you had to have a liter of water and 2 liters of something breadish to eat. And oh yeah, your sheep require about a minimum of 1.5 liters today to on upward, and cows, of course, will drink like horses or cows if given the opportunity. So first of all, there was a lot of water to be had, but there wasn't a lot to be had. So where do they drink water? What's the scriptures tell us about that time? How do they get their water?
The rocks.
There were times when God, through Moses, brought water out of the ground, out of a rock, right? There's also a place where they had 70 palm trees. It was a big oasis. It's still there, okay? There was a natural spring in oasis. There's another place called Marah or Meribah. Why was it called Marah or Meribah? Because the waters were bitter. And in fact, in Hebrew, that's what the word Marah means, bitter. There is a place called the Sea of Reeds in the Sinai, which is a huge marsh, and the water there stinks. It's brackish. Most people can't stand to drink it. It is fed by what geologists have found is a massive underground aquifer. Now, Moses had the people up at that well at one time. In fact, in Arabic, the name of the place is the Springs of Moses in Arabic today. The Arabic word means the Springs of Moses. It's one of those places. The waters that were there, but the waters were bitter and the people couldn't drink it, and they complained. And God told Moses to throw a tree of a certain kind in the water, and it made the water sweet and they could drink it. Now the water is bitter today, but it was sweet back then when he drank it. But geologists have found that there's a massive underground aquifer under the Sinai Peninsula. There is amazing amounts of water underneath that desert. The problem is, it's way down deep. Okay? Now, those of you who grew up in Texas, how many grew up here in Texas? Oh, come on, Mama, you and I grew up in Texas. Anyway, so Texas has a similar structure, geologic structure. It's called the Edwards Aquifer. The Edwards Aquifer is a giant underground limestone formation that covers pretty much, if you drew a circle in the middle of Texas, on a big map of Texas, that's the Edwards Aquifer. It's a massive amount of underground water. Now, what happens when there's lots and lots and lots of underground water? You know what it does? It comes up out of the ground. And you've heard about artesian wells, right? An artesian well is where water bubbles up out of the ground as springs. Okay? Well, I grew up down there. I grew up in Lavernia, Texas, which is close to San Antonio, and there, about a 30-40 mile up the farm to market roads, there's a town called New Braunfels. And New Braunfels lives on the Guadalupe River, which is also fed by the Comal Springs. The Comal Springs come out of the Edwards Aquifer. There is a giant natural spring-fed swimming pool up there called Land Park. And I went there as a kid and as a teenager. And ice cold, probably 50 degrees or so water, comes gushing out at the end of this giant pool. Big wading pool, big kind of playing area, and two Olympic-sized pools on the end and a diving section. It's all fed by spring of water coming up about this thick and about 50 degrees and gushing. And has been gushing for as long as people have been here. Except it's a couple of really dry years. In fact, when the Spaniards first came here, they discovered Indians camping around this spring from as far away as New Mexico. Because this was such an amazing place with all this fresh water. Yes?
I have drank water from an artesian well.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out around a little bubbly.
Yeah.
Cold and just as fresh.
It's good stuff.
Delicious.
So we have artesian wells around here in North Carolina, especially in the mountains, right? And you can go around, you can find water bubbling up out of the ground. So first of all, they had to have a lot of water. I calculated it about 538,000 gallons a day per person, just to get the minimum. Now, they probably had more than that, but just to get the minimum. And about 600,000 gallons a day, so let's just round it up and say, you know, we're on a million two gallons. Just the 538,000 gallons is 35 tank trucks every day would have had to pull into the middle of the Hebrew camp to provide them water. So obviously they didn't have tank trucks. So how much water is that? So I calculated it, and it turns out if you had a gallon, and Letha graciously gave me a gallon of her tea to use so this is a gallon of water, a gallon of iced tea actually. They didn't have this in the desert. They wouldn't have complained. They had a gallon. If you have a gallon and you have it gushing out of the ground, so if you had a hole about this big, so 1 gallon would go through it about this much, and you stack 12 of those, you had a 12-foot high geyser coming out of the ground this thick, and it went 24 hours a day for as long as they were there, and sometimes they were in one place for 2 years, that's 538,000 gallons. A day. By the way, this is a day. So 1 million gallons a day had to come out. In other words, you had gushes of water 1 to 2 feet wide, 10 to 12 feet high. So when Moses, you know, a lot of times you see these things, you know, in the movies or something where Moses talks to the rock, right? And what happens? A little bubbling out. It looks like those artesian wells. Now, this was a gusher. This was a gusher. And it made a serious lake. And if you just think about the time it would take for 2 million people to come and get water and water their cattle and their sheep, it had to be a pretty big lake because they couldn't all get around it. So this is what life was like. God provided gushers, lakes of water, not just a little water to drink, lakes of water for them. Every time they went to a place, if it didn't have a natural source of water, God made them a lake right there, a whole lake. So that's the water part. Let's talk about the food part. So when they came out of Israel, out of Egypt, it said they had food with them. Remember, because why did they eat unleavened bread? Because they didn't have time to let it rise. And it says when they left Egypt, they carried the dough in the kneading troughs. The morning bread that they were making, they were in such a hurry to get out that they didn't even take time for the bread to rise and cook it. They kept the dough in the kneading troughs and took it with them on the road. But after a while, they ran out of the flour they had in Egypt. Okay? Who knows how long that was? Well, we know when they started having manna, because the scriptures tell us. If you want to look all this up and talk about it, it's in Exodus 16 and Numbers 11. In particular, Exodus 16, I want to read, because this is where it starts talking about the manna. And we're going to talk about manna for a while. So we're in Exodus 16. Verse 1. So they journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation, children of Israel, came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai. And on the 15th day of the second month, they departed from, on the 15th day of the second month after they departed from Egypt. If Stephen was here, he'd go, you see, on the timeline, here it is. He'd say where it is. The whole congregation complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said to them, oh, we had died in the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt when we sat by pots of meat and we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out in this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. Then the Lord said to Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. And the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. And it shall be on the sixth day that they will prepare what they bring in, and it will be twice as much as they gather daily. Because, of course, they were not supposed to do work on the Sabbath. Then Moses and Aaron said to all the children of Israel, at evening you shall know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt. So he said, first of all, this is going to be proof. They're saying, Moses, you and Aaron brought us out here to die, didn't you? And they said, no, the Lord brought you out. And to prove that, this is what's going to happen. So that's what he says. At evening you shall know the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt. In the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, for he hears your complaints against the Lord. But what are we that you complain against us? And also Moses said, this shall be seen when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and the morning bread to the full. For the Lord hears your complaints which you make against him. And what are we? Your complaints are not against us, but the Lord. Then Moses spake to Aaron, said, say to all the congregation, children of Israel, come near before the Lord. He has heard your complaints. Now it came to pass, as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation, children of Israel, they looked out toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. Now remember, this is something I'm not going to spend a lot of time on. But what happened when they left Egypt? Who chased them?
Pharaoh.
Yeah, and his army. They changed their mind and went after them. When they ran across them was where they were at the Red Sea, right? Because they were pinned against the army in the Red Sea. Why didn't soldiers just come and just start whacking the people? Because the Lord guided them with a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire at night. And then that went behind them and stood between them. And it was darkness on the side of the Egyptians and light on the side of the Hebrews. Remember? So they had this pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire. A pillar of cloud, you'd say, well, someone's down there making smoke signals or something. A pillar of fire at night, all night. A pillar. That means way up. You could see it way up. Okay? They had that within 40 years. Because it says that wherever that stood is where they put the tabernacle and everybody camped around it. And when it got up and left, they all got up and left. And when it went down, they stood there. So they had this giant pillar of fire every single night, giving them light. And a pillar of cloud every single day. Okay, so this is more. So here we go. So the glory of the Lord shows, and the glory of the Lord appeared in a cloud, verse 11, and the Lord spoke to Moses and said, I've heard the complaints of children of Israel. Speak to them and say, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord. So it was that quails came up at evening and covered the camp, and in the morning dew lay all around the camp. And when the layer of dew lifted, there on the surface of the wilderness was a small round substance, as fine as frost on the ground. So when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, this is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is the thing which the Lord has commanded. Let every man gather it according to one's need, one omer for each person, according to the number of persons, and let every man take those who are in his tent. Then the children of Israel did so and gathered, some more and some less. But so when they measured it by omers, he who gathered much had nothing left over, and he who gathered little had no lack. Every man had gathered according to each one's need. And Moses said, let no one leave any of it till morning. Notwithstanding, they did not heed Moses, but some left part of it till morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them, so they gathered it every morning, every man according to his need, and after the sun became hot, it melted. Now we're going to stop there for a second. So, two things. God said, you're going to have meat to eat at night, and you're going to have bread to eat in the morning. That was, by the way, a pretty common order of eating. In the morning, they would have bread, and in the evening is when they would eat meat, just in general. So, we'll talk about the quail in a minute. Let's talk about the manna. So, first of all, it says the children of Israel said what? What is it? They'd never seen it before. This was not a natural thing. In fact, the word manna means, what is it? So, what is this stuff you're eating? Oh, it's the what is it stuff. I mean, that's literally what it means. So, listen to the description of it. Listen to the description. Let me get down here where the description is. Okay, gather it. Yeah, I'm going to gather it. Let's see, where's the thing? It's like frost on the ground. Where does it say that? There it is. So it was that quails came up in the evening, covered the camp, and in the morning the dew lay all around the camp. And when the layer of dew lifted, there on the surface of the wilderness was a small round substance as fine as frost on the ground. Now, we have frost here in North Carolina, so y'all know what frost looks like. Fine as frost on the ground. So is this big chunks of stuff on the ground? No. In another place, it describes manna as like white coriander seed. You ever seen a coriander seed? It's about the size of a BB, maybe a little bit bigger than a BB. So the ground was covered with this stuff, little bitty granules, white granules, between white and yellow. And there's another place where it said it had the color of delium. Delium was an aromatic gum sap that would drip from some of the bushes there that they could eat. And it says they picked it up. They had to pick it up, and they had to pick up an omer. An omer is about 2.2 liters. So there it is. Basically, this is how much they had to pick up of manna for every person. Now, if I scattered BBs all over the ground, if this was full of BBs and I scattered it on the ground, how long would it take you to pick that up?
Long time.
Probably quite a while. You'd be scooping it up. Now, we don't know how thick it was on the ground. It was obviously fairly thick. They were able to get this much every day for 2 million people. So how many, I didn't do the calculation, but we can guess. How many 2-liter bottles would fit on the floor of this room?
Bunch.
I would say maybe 20,000, maybe 30,000. So you're talking about this room stacked high with 2-liter bottles was how much stuff they had to pick every day. Someone had to go out. It said not everybody went out. It said, you know, take it back for the people in your tent. So, but some people gathered much and some people gathered little. But when they got back, they all had exactly enough. Now, is that physics or is that God? That's God, right? So here they go making this stuff. And there's another place where it says, bake what you will bake and boil what you would boil. And on the sixth day, and it says that on the sixth day, the day before the Sabbath, go ahead and prepare it, and it will be enough. You'll have enough left over that you won't have to go gather it on the Sabbath day. And it even said there's not going to be any on the Sabbath day, and it also said some people went out anyway, and there wasn't any. So 6 days a week, in the morning, when the dew went away, you had little white BBs of food all over the ground. Masses of it. People would go out, scoop it up, take it in. And by the time the sun got hot, it vanished away. It melted away, it says. And then on the seventh day, there wasn't any there. This is what they went through for 40 years. Every single day. Yeah.
And it just shows God, because 6 days, five out of those 6 days, if they tried to save it till morning,
it stank.
It stank. But on the sixth day, they gathered double, and on the seventh day, it was still fine.
Right.
People today, I hear people all the time saying, well, if God would just really speak to us like he did back in those days, we would believe more. They didn't, and he was giving them stuff like this every day, and they still didn't honor him and believe him sometimes.
Go ahead, Carol.
And even today in the scripture, it tells us God will supply all our needs.
He will supply all your needs for every purpose, for every good work, right? Now, you led me to my punchlines, and one of my punchlines is, so after this 40 years and all the old generation had died off and they were sitting there they're ready to cross the river. Literally the next day they were going to cross the river into the promised land. You know what Joshua said? Now get rid of the goat idols you've been carrying around with you since we left Egypt. Now hold it. These are the same people. These are the same people who saw the pillar of cloud, the pillar of fire, who had lakes of water, of fresh sweet water, which is rare in the desert, just bubble up for them, which had metric tons. I didn't even calculate how many truckloads of manna had to be dumped every morning for these people to eat and survive. Every single day. And yet they carried around their goat idols. And still apparently worship their goat idols. And so don't tell me I just need to see one more miracle, right? Because these people have saw it every single day. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about manna. How did manna taste? It says. No. It said like wafers spread with oil and wafers spread with honey are two different places it talks about it. Now, if I take flour, all you cooks out there, if I take flour and I mix a little oil with it, they had olive oil, so let's just say we mix a little olive oil with it, and I mix a little honey with it, and I put it on a hot rock or a pan and I bake it, what's it going to taste like?
It's
cookie.
Cookies or pancakes. I mean, something of that order. You know, in our experience, wafer spread with honey would be cookies. God gave them cookies to eat every single day for 40 years. He gave them cookies.
Little kids were bound to be happy.
Oh, yeah. And some of the people got really sick and tired of it, didn't they? And this is where we get to the quail. So we're going to talk about the quail. Now, it actually turns out that the first notice, he said, in the evening they had quail, in that very first set. So this happened to be around April. If Stephen was here, he could tell us the exact month, I don't remember. And it turns out that quail, all the quail in a big chunk of Europe migrate to Africa every year. So in the fall, they migrate down to Africa. And in the spring, around April, they head up through Palestine and the Sinai Peninsula and go up into from Africa, and sometimes they come over the ocean too, and they come through the Sinai Peninsula and they go up into Europe to breed and feed during the year. So it's not uncommon, actually, for there to be large, huge migrations of quail in this area at certain times of year. And quail, how many of you have ever hunted quail? What happens when you get close to a covey of quail? They go right. They fly really, really fast.
Scare you to death, man.
And they do scare you to death. That's right. And it's one of their survival tactics to scare you so bad that you can't get your gun up in time to shoot them. But how far do they fly?
Not very far.
Not very far. They're little fat round birds, right? They can fly really fast for a short period of time, and they go down on the ground. And when you're hunting quail, what you got to do is you'll scare them. Now you know where they are. You have a dog that spooks them. And then you go see where they land. And then you kind of sneak up on them and you get ready, you know, and then you can shoot them. But there are so many quail coming by and they are so tired because they fly at night and they fly for like 30 minutes at a time because that's about all they can do. They are so exhausted that they can't fly very high off the ground. And there's so many of them that even today, you can go there, and during the migration, you can just basically grab a net and just go, whoosh, and just grab you up a big old mess of quail. Now, so one, was it miraculous that there were quail? No, because there are quail there migrate all the time. It happened to be the time of the quail migration. Was it miraculous that they were there every evening for 40 years? Absolutely. Why? Because the quail migration only happens, that northward migration only happens once a year. God gave them lots of quail. So they had meat to eat. They didn't complain about it then, notice. They started complaining 2 years later, it turns out, and this is what Numbers 11 is. It said the people who were with them, the hangers-on, started complaining and going like, man, we got, you know, all we had all kinds of great food to eat in Egypt, you know, and all we got here is this manna. And you can just hear the disgust in their voice. We don't got no meat. We got nothing but manna. You know, cookies from God. Okay? Cookies from God. And they were saying, bleh.
What did they not eat in their cattle?
Common question. They got all these cattle and sheep. Why didn't they eat them? First of all, they probably got milk from them. And by the way, if you go to a lot of places in the world where they raise a lot of cattle and a lot of sheep, they don't eat a lot of the meat. They eat a lot of the milk. And they do eat meat. I mean, they do eat them, right? But they don't eat them like, you know, we go to McDonald's and have a hamburger every day. They didn't eat a whole lot of meat, a lot, anyway. But the other thing was, is they were shepherds. There are two theories I ran across, one I thought was interesting. One of them is, this was their wealth, right? This was their, what they were taking it to the promised land. So they didn't want to eat them all up on the way to the promised land. They wanted to have livestock when they got to the promised land. They were shepherds. They knew about managing big herds of cattle and profiting off of those cattle. The other theory was that, that the Egyptians had worshipped them, right? The golden calf. Why did they make a golden calf? Because they're shepherds. And calves were worshipped in Egypt. And many of them probably still picked up a lot of those Egyptian things and were continuing to do it. Just like Joshua said, get rid of the goat idols. right? But one way or the other, they didn't eat a lot of them. They didn't eat them all. And, you know, Moses even says when God's going to send them in Numbers 11. I should say first. So God sent them quail that night. Now, whether they had quail every single night is a bit of a dispute in scholars, because you don't hear about it again until the next year. Okay? So they might have sent them quail one night. You might have had it every night. We don't know, because it doesn't make it real clear. But about a year later, the people start complaining, and the hangers-on, King James translated it, or Moffat translated it, riffraff, started complaining they didn't have any meat. And Moses got frustrated, and he said, where am I going to find meat for 600,000 men? And he was telling, you know, he was frustrated. So it, and they wanted more, you know, they said, we used to have fish all the time because we were by the Nile River. You know, we want something else. And God said, okay, because you're giving in to your lust for meat, I'm going to give you meat. I'm going to give you enough meat that you're going to eat it for a solid month until it comes out of your nose. That's what he says, until it comes out of your nostrils. And such a large deposit of quail landed that night, that evening, that it was a day's journey on either side of the camp, the Bible says. Now, there were 3 million people in the camp. That's a city. That's the size of Spartanburg or Greenville, right? That's a city. And a day's walk on either side, 2 cubits high of quail. Now, they were sitting there. One of the things that God tells them before he says this, he says, is my arm too short to feed you? Have I not been, they've been eating manna for now how long, right? This is one of the arguments that said they didn't have quail every night because they've been eating manna all this time. They were grumbling because they wanted meat. And God said, am I too weak to provide you food? I tell you what, I'll show you. So he dumped 3 feet of quail, exhausted migrating quail who are so exhausted you can walk around and pick them up even today because they're just wiped out. They can't fly. 3 feet deep of quail over the entire city of the camp and a day's journey in either direction. And they started picking them up. They picked them up all night, all day, and all the next night, the Bible says. Which brings me to my third visual aid. It says that the least of them, the most slacker of the bunch, picked up 10 homers of quail. 10 homers. That said, all the people went out. So you got millions of people picking up quail. They're knee high or waist high, depending on how tall you were. And they're picking up quail. A homer is 220 liters. Okay, an omer is the amount of, it's the 2 liters basically. It's the amount, it's 2.2 liters. It's the amount of manna that everybody had to have a day. A homer is 220 liters. 220 liters turns into about 50 gallons. Which is about the amount of air I've got in this bag right now. It's 50 gallons. So this bag full of quail, how heavy would that be? Pretty heavy. Times 10, which would be about all a donkey could carry, times 2 million. That's a lot of birds. It says that they spread them out all over the camp. Now what does that mean? First of all, they wrung their neck, probably. And they spread them out to dry. To preserve. So God dumps 3 feet of quail on them. And they're trying to preserve it. Like, man, we got all this quail. No, wait, we eat all this stuff. So we're going to try to dry it out and preserve it. And it says God was going to give them enough quail for a whole month. And it says the people who craved the meat started eating it. And it said God was so angry with them for their rebellion and their lack of trust in him that he struck them with a plague. It says while the meat was still in their teeth, he struck them with a plague. There's an academic paper, actually, really interesting paper done in 1999 of a guy who said, okay, well, what was this plague? And he studied the whole thing about the quail migrations and everything else. And there are several thoughts. One of them was all that quail meat went bad, okay, and they got sick, right? The other one was, which I found fascinating, was the Romans actually liked quail. In fact, everybody liked quail. You ever had quail? Quail is very delicate meat. It's very rich in fat. It's breast meat. I mean, all you eat on nothing in a quail except the breast. I mean, that's all you get, right? It's good stuff. It's good eating. But the Romans liked it, but then they said they didn't prefer it because sometimes it would make you sick. And it turns out that Plutarch, or one of the Roman writers, said the reason was, that it would make you sick. And the sickness was like the sickness of hemlock poisoning. And it turns out that the big quail migrations come through Libya. And when they do, one guy did a study. He went back and looked. He says, what do they eat? Turns out they eat a bunch of poisonous plants. They eat a bunch of hemlock seeds. A quail will eat any kind of seed on the ground. And so if they had an extra big bloom of hemlock seeds and all these birds had eaten these hemlock seeds and they came and all of a sudden they were gobbling down quail, not just one or two, mind you. Remember, they were craving meat lustfully. So they were gorging themselves with quail. They got overdosed on hemlock. Guess what the symptoms of hemlock overdose are besides death? Nausea and vomiting. Until it comes out of your nostrils. You see how all that comes together? Isn't that amazing? And, you know, science, whenever science tries to go at God, God always wins. It's one of the wonderful things about it. Now, so, there's all that quail. By the way, do you think maybe they were done with quail after that episode? Have you ever gotten sick on some food? When I was a kid, I used to love to eat. My mom made biscuits and gravy almost every Saturday morning with sausage. We used to have a big old plate of sausage, and I love sausage. And one Saturday morning, she made an extra big batch, and I ate the whole thing. And I got sick. I couldn't eat sausage for maybe 6 years. It took me a long time. Because the way your body does with that, if you eat something that makes you sick, your body said, don't eat any of that or more, because that'll make you sick. You think maybe they were complaining for quail again after this episode? Probably not. But for 40 years, God fed them cookies from heaven. Gave them light at night and a cloud in the day. Gave them lakes of water in the desert. Gushers, geysers of pure water in the desert. Said their shoes never wore out. You know, I go through a pair of leather gloves a couple times a year, just working in my yard. Okay? Their shoes didn't wear out. 40 years, their shoes and their clothes did not wear out. Can you imagine a whole generation of growing up kids without their clothes wearing out? And it says their joints didn't swell. They weren't unhealthy. Now, there's one other little tiny bit I want to throw in here. I thought I'd put this in just because, you know, when you think about somebody living out in the desert, big group of people living out in the desert, there's another problem. You can eat and you drink, but what happens after you eat and you drink? You gotta go. So I said, okay, so just for fun, I thought I'm going to calculate it. So how much excrement does a person on average produce a day? 14 ounces, it turns out. 14 ounces per day per person of that many people, 22 semi-tractor trailer loads of poo. 22 semi-tractor trailer loads of poo every day. So here's all the 35 tank trucks of water coming in, right? Here's the metric tons of manna falling down. Here's 3 feet of quail coming in. And then there's 22 truckloads of poo coming out every day. I mean, this is a massive undertaking, right? But then I realized something. What were they eating those 40 years? Manna. What happened to manna when the sun came out? It melted away. What was the color of manna? It said like delium. Delium was that aromatic resin that you can actually chew. You can pick it off of bushes and chew. It's an aromatic resin. That means that it off-gasses, basically, in organic chemistry terms, and it will melt. So God fed them with cookies from heaven that their body probably absorbed almost 100% of the nutrients. Now, he does tell them, he says, when you have to go, you take a spade with you and you bury it, right? He told them, he said, you know, these are camp rules. You know, if you're out in the desert and you got to go, you've got to take a spade with you and bury your excrement. But God fed them with cookies from heaven that were almost 100% absorbed. In other words, it was perfect food, absolutely perfect food, and produced almost no waste. This is what it was like living in the desert for 40 years. So, That was the lesson. And these people still had goat idols. And these people still were unfaithful. Remember what Stephen was saying? They went in, they crossed into the land, they started taking over. God gave them every victory all over the place. And what happened? Did they kick out all the Canaanites? No, he said, and they didn't get it all done. Why did they not get it all done? Because of their lack of faith. These are all the men who and women who had lived there for 40 years and had been fed cookies from heaven. So that tells you something about humans, doesn't it? Yeah, we're no better than they are, by the way. we have that much struggle, too.
You wonder how these people could be exposed to that and not believe. I mean, how dumb can you get? But then, you look at us today, and we have non-believers.
Yeah.
We just go to Angles and get our quail. You know, we wait at the mailbox for provisions to get to Vanna.
Yeah, we don't even have to go to the store anymore. You know, Amazon will deliver it to your door. So we don't even have to get out of the tent.
How dumb can we get then?
And you know what? Even Christians. I mean, it's easy to look at unbelievers and say, you know, well, yeah, all these unbelievers. But how often is our faith so weak that we don't trust God? You know, we think, no, God can't handle this one. You know, we're that way too. It's amazing. I've said it many, many times, but it's amazing that we weren't a floating cinder in the universe as a planet many, many thousands of years ago, because God is so gracious and so merciful. He puts up with so much from us. I mean, that's the first thing you ought to do is fall on your knees and say, thank you, God, for being patient with me. You know, forgiveness and all that stuff too, but thank you for being patient with me. Okay, we'll stop there.